Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I am your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring the films of John Carpenter, as recommended by Reed Lackey, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about Escape from New York. But before I get into the discussion on Escape from New York, I do want to do a little bit of housekeeping, which is address the sense that, as I alluded to in the last episode, this is my 100th episode with an asterisk. I have actually done more than 100 episodes, some bonuses, some side episodes here and there, but in terms of the ones that I am counting as the official kind of numbered episodes adding to the, let's say, the maybe canon of the show, this is my 100th episode. I don't have a lot planned, and by a lot planned, I mean I don't really have anything planned. I don't have any fanfare, I don't have any special promotions or giveaways, and there's no guest here joining me aside from my pre-war radiator, which has just recently decided to shut up in time for the show. Thank you very much, pre-war radiator. But I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for other people, so I do feel like there are some people I have to thank first and foremost, so let me do that. Starting with past guests, people who have joined the show, who have added to the conversation, who in my mind are actually the stars of this podcast, because they are the ones that incite me to explore, they engage me in discussion, and they make me excited to broaden my horizons, basically. So in no particular order, I am sending thanks out to David Bax, Josh Long, Gavin Mevious, Daniel Walber, Reed Lackey, Tim Buell, Andy Beach, James McCormick, Rudy Obias, Alonzo Duralde, Kristen Sales, Jenny Miller, Charles Epting, Matt Bradley Shergi, Scott Nye, and Tyler Smith. And Tyler Smith is arguably, if not for him, I might not even be doing this podcast, so I do want to send a little bit of, maybe a little bit extra thanks out to him. So thank you to everyone who has been a guest in the past. There we go. If any of you still listen to this podcast after your part was done, I do thank you. But I thank you to, or thank you for contributing to the conversation, for giving me an excitement and passion to allow me to keep going. And then of course I want to thank the listeners. I know there are not many of you out there. That is something which is sort of humbling, and something that it kind of took me some time to orient myself and kind of get used to. But I recognize that there are not many of you out there, but those of you who are out there, those of you who have chimed in, and even if not, if you are just still a regular listener, I have to thank you for that, because as a listener named Chris, explained to me earlier, or at least expressed to me earlier, if you were not interested in the things that I have to say in what I'm doing, then you would not be coming back. And so there may not be a whole lot of you out there, but there are some of you out there who do see some value in what I do, who do get some enjoyment in what I do. And so because of the fact that there are still people who are regularly kind of downloading this episode, that is, of course, is one of the main reasons that I continue doing this. So for past guests, thank you for contributing to this conversation. For the listeners, thank you for giving me kind of encouragement and a reason to continue doing this. So with all that sentiment out of the way, let's get into the discussion on Escape from New York. And it's good that we're getting the sentiment out of the way, because I'm sure I'm going to upset a whole lot of people by saying I didn't really care for Escape from New York. In fact, I think having come to this movie as late as I did, the fact that I was not raised on this movie, thank you, Radiator, for chiming in. Expressing, of course, the anger that I'm sure most of you are feeling now that I said something about not liking it. But the fact that I wasn't raised with this movie, the fact that I did not, I guess, didn't stumble upon it was when I was in film school or in those kind of like formative cinematic years. Coming to it late as I did, I think maybe that sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but I think right now my mindset is sort of that Escape from New York is one of those movies where if you kind of get to a certain age or a certain point in your life and you haven't seen it, maybe you don't have to see it. Sort of like Easy Rider. You know, Easy Rider is one of those movies which is certainly important and formative in regards to what it contributed to cinema, especially at the time. But if you haven't seen it by now, you're probably not going to see it, and you probably shouldn't. That's not to say that either movie is bad per se. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that Escape from New York is a bad movie, but I just sort of found it like an okay movie. And I know it's commonly described as a cult classic, which is a term which sort of honestly makes me a little skeptical, because cult classic a lot of times sort of has the implication of, you know, it's not very good, but a lot of people liked it, or there was a following to it. And there is still a lot to admire about Escape from New York. It certainly is sort of a very much a John Carpenter movie from, you know, through and through, but it's also a John Carpenter movie, like, and that means in good ways, and also in not so good ways. And I guess why not, you know, get into it? I guess I'll start with the good things, because a lot of these good things are the things that's kind of stood out or that I appreciated, are the things that are nothing new. I'm not adding anything to the conversation by talking about the points I'm about to talk through. In fact, are the things that, you know, the people who love the film probably love it for these reasons, or at the very least, at first blush, you know, you're going to watch this movie, and those are things that are going to stand out to you. So first and foremost, of course, Escape from New York sings the song that was, I don't know where I was going with that analogy or that metaphor, so I'll just say instead, Escape from New York is sort of the quintessential John Carpenter anti-authority movie. First and foremost, because of course you have Snake Plissken as the anti-hero, the very famous, the iconic at this point, Snake Plissken, as played by Kurt Russell. God knows I love Kurt Russell. Snake Plissken I have other feelings about, which I will certainly get into a little bit, but first and foremost, you have an anti-hero, a criminal, Snake Plissken, at the heart of this as a protagonist, who has to go into, who is sort of coerced, you know, kind of made an offer he can't refuse by these authority figures. These authority figures are, of course, the police force in the prison island of Manhattan. And they're certainly represented by you know, Lee Van Cleef and Charles Cyphers as sort of the two main figures of authority. But one thing that stood out to me visually and how Carpenter sort of depicts the police force and this visualization of authority is through facelessness. If you look at a lot of the guards, aside from Lee Van Cleef and aside from Charles Cyphers and aside from President Donald Pleasance, the police and the authority are represented by faceless, anonymous goons, almost, that were they in any other movie, you would mistake them for the cronies of the bad guy, because they are dressed all in black, they always carry weapons, and they have shields guarding their faces. You know, they are sort of the metaphorical red shirts. They are, you know, the bait. They are there to kind of get killed by our hero, but a lot of times our hero is a very clear-cut good guy who is fighting against an authoritative force, kind of a fascist force. In here, that authority and that fascism is the United States government, is the police force, and they are faceless. They are anonymous goons who are just sort of there, as meat, as bodies who are going to get killed. And also the world that they live in, this world outside the wall, the kind of the security compound that exists on Liberty Island, is very much looks like a villain's lair from a James Bond movie, with all the flashing lights and computers in the background. It's very brightly and evenly lit. There's kind of no shadows. It's a very sterile environment. You know, I'll say it again. It sort of reminded me of the villain's lair in a James Bond film. That would be buried in, you know, like deep in the heart of a mountain. But instead, this is a bright, an open, a safe space, which is far removed from the setting of our story, which is, of course, the prison island of Manhattan. And once you get into the prison island of Manhattan, it is a very different story. It is, of course, a land dominated by savages, which is, you know, where there's garbage and fires on every corner, and where, you know, it's every man for himself, and you just have roaming uncivilized masses kind of roaming the streets, and because the film takes place at night, and because they're working with a low budget, the lighting is very harsh. You know, a lot of Carpenter said that a lot of times they sort of were working with, if not a single light, then, you know, certainly not a full lighting setup, and so that's why you get these very harsh shadows, these kind of single, what seems to be single solitary light sources on these crowded crowded deserted. I just contradicted myself with two words right back to back. But these crowded, broken down, gang controlled streets, and so there's also, of course, within this authoritative force, there's no ethnic diversity. You know, the police are all kind of oppressive figures of white power. Not white power in the sense of alt-right neo-Nazi white power, but I mean they are the roles of power are all filled by sort of untouchable white people. And all the ethnic diversity sort of exists in here in the real world, you know, kind of in the big city, in this urban environment. You do kind of have a subtle suggestion of urban versus suburban. And this is just me kind of filling in the blanks, but the only vegetation you see is kind of trees that are on Liberty Island. So it sort of, to me, sort of reinforced this subconscious idea of urban versus suburban, which I think is something that is very much conscious, or at least in the forefront of Carpenter's mind, you know, especially if we think back to Assault on Precinct 13th, and if you believe, as I do, that he is kind of satirizing the fear of urban Los Angeles, of, you know, oh my God, it's all a war zone in there, you know, it's every man for himself. And so there's certainly that sort of stuff, and I certainly appreciate this. Obviously, the person who we are supposed to be rooting for is Snake Plissken, and the person that we are supposed to be kind of disgusted by is President Donald Pleasence. And of course, that stems from Carpenter's sort of reaction to Watergate and to kind of seeing, you know, presidential overreach and the fact that the president sort of didn't care about people. And so we have an authoritative figure who is, you know, he is rescued at the end, but he's clearly doesn't care about the lives that were lost, the lives that were sacrificed for his own life. He kind of glances over them, and which of course leads to what I admit is a hilarious ending with the swap tapes and Snake Plissken walking away, tearing the diplomatic tape up, which may have indeed led to some type of world peace. But you have sort of that Carpenter giving the middle finger, if you will, and sort of like, well, these people here that you have shit on, these prisoners, these people that you have overlooked, that you don't even care about, if they're not going to get peace, if they're not going to be considered equals, then why should you have peace? Which is something that I certainly, if not appreciate, then can empathize with or can understand sort of that mindset. And then, of course, you have, you have John Carpenter homaging the Western genre, which is, I do find it really interesting that, you know, he does it, that influence is very heavy in both Assault on Precinct 13th and Escape from New York, but Assault on Precinct 13 did it differently, because you sort of had, the precinct was the last vestige of civilization, and they were fighting off these forces that were coming from, you know, outside. It was the savages who were trying to invade this little slice of civilization, but instead, it's the inverse. In Escape from New York, in the sense of our hero, our anti-hero, which once again is a very, maybe not very, but certainly a thing which sort of rose to prominence in the Western. You know, you can think of a lot of the characters that Clint Eastwood played in his heyday as a Western superstar, if you will. But you sort of have this anti-hero with sort of a murky, not quite certain past, who is instead leaving security and is going out into the wilderness, which is going out into a metaphorical Wild West on a quest, you know, and sort of you can almost kind of think back, or not think back, but you can almost kind of make the comparison, of course, that the gangs of criminals that he is encountering are sort of like, back in, if you were looking at a Western in the 1950s or the 1940s, like, those were supposed to be the and I'm not saying this because I believe this, but these are the savages, the Indians, the Native Americans. Though, you know, there's the very clear comparison between those two. So you have our hero, instead of trying to uphold or defend the last vestige of civilization, you have him leaving civilization and going out into the wasteland in order to achieve his goal or come back. And then, of course, you have Carpenter doing what he does best, which is using using actors to the best of their abilities, and there's some great casting, and some of the great casting includes some Western stars. Of course, you have Ernest Borgnine, who was in The Wild Bunch and High Noon, and then, of course, you have Lee Van Cleef of Sergio Leone's Dollars trilogy. And then, like I said, you have Snake Plissken as the anti-hero, which is very much, which was a thing that was not uncommon to see in the Western. You know, they weren't all John Wayne. Sometimes they were... Clint Eastwood. I was about to say Henry Ford. That doesn't make any sense because Henry Ford is not even an actor. Henry Ford invented the assembly line. I think what I was trying to think of was Henry Fonda, and that's probably not even correct because if I remember correctly, Henry Fonda played the bad guy in Once Upon a Time in the West. It's funny how the brain works. But anyway, where was I? So you kind of have that, and that's something that I certainly appreciate, the way that Carpenter wears his influences on his sleeve, but he works with them and he sort of tweaks them and he changes them and he uses them for his own devices. That is certainly something that I can very much appreciate. And I don't want to say that's where it stops, but I'll at least say, like, those things I think everybody can get on board with. Everyone sort of is already on board with. Even Roger Ebert, who wasn't a big fan of this movie, still kind of said, like, at least Carpenter had all the parts in place, you know? They might not have been assembled together in the correct way, but at least he had all the right parts. But the assembly is just a little bit weird, and I think here's where it starts. I'll start with this point, because this is the one which is very specific to me. Other people might share my opinions, but I'm going to assume that it is not shared by the vast majority of the audience out there, and that is that I have a real problem with how the city of New York is depicted. And before anybody out there, turns this off or starts thinking negatively of me in the sense of, like, you damn New York City elite, you isolationist. It's not the fact that I'm like, oh, this isn't how New York is like. My quarrel is not the fact that my problem is not verisimilitude. You know, my problem is not the fact that it's like, oh, if this is New York, where's the George Washington Bridge or where's the Brooklyn Bridge or where's Central Park? It's not the fact that I think that I have a problem with the fact that he got the details wrong. Because I know, number one, I know this wasn't shot in New York City. It was shot in St. Louis, which they were chosen at the time because St. Louis was, and from what I understand, still kind of is a very much a broken city. So they shot it there. They shot it in St. Louis. So I know it wasn't going to look like New York City because they weren't going to shoot it there. And I also understand, number two, Carpenter was working on a tremendously tight budget. I believe back in, the 1980s when he was working on this movie, it was still, he was only working with, like, I think $6 or $7 million, which is not a lot of money to be making a film like this, which is certainly supposed to be, dystopian, not really post-apocalyptic, but certainly, it was an ambitious movie. It was much more ambitious than Assault on Precinct Thing. One episode later, and I still am having trouble pronouncing that title. It's much more ambitious than Assault on Precinct 13. It's much more ambitious than Halloween. At least in regards to the scope and what he's trying to depict. You know, he's outside of a single location. He's outside of a suburb. He's here in what is supposed to be a destroyed prison island of Manhattan. So my problem is not the fact that it's like, oh, where's this landmark or where's that? It wasn't the fact that I'm looking for that. I'm like, it's not New York City. It doesn't look anything like New York City. My problem is that he doesn't utilize the potential of New York City to not illuminate, but to kind of supplement his world. I mean, you have this idea, okay, it's like, okay, so why is it significant that Manhattan is the prison? I guess, one, sure, tactically it makes sense because it is an island. You can isolate it. You can put, in theory, a giant wall around it. But then there also has to be something about New York City. If you're going to set your story in New York City, you're going to do it because it's not Chicago, because it's not St. Louis, because it's not Toronto, because it's not Los Angeles. So what is it about New York City? And outside of that sort of gimmick of, oh, well, it makes sense because it's an island and we can, if you wanted to build a giant prison colony, you could in theory do it. Outside of that, there's nothing about this world that is interesting. And by that, I mean, it sort of seems like Carpenter had, you know, I know he had been to New York City before he wrote this, because he's even said, or it has been said, that he visited New York City in kind of some of the seedier parts, and so that also helped inspire this idea, which I also have quarrels with that, John Carpenter, but I'll get back to that in a little bit. So I know that he knew of New York City, but it didn't seem like he was familiar with New York City. Like, he just knew neighborhoods, he just knew terms, he just knew archetypes, like the New York City cab driver, and kind of threw them all together without really having an understanding of what makes them special or what makes them work. Because when you do have a place like New York City, especially, like, when you do have that, you know, do something with the diversity of the land, or this inherent idea of, like, okay, there are neighborhoods, there's the Upper West Side, there's the Lower East Side, there's Midtown, there's Chinatown, which you shouldn't take that to too much of an extreme, in which then you kind of have him copying the Warriors, but it's this idea of, like, okay, hell, even in Gangs of New York, even in the book or the movie of Gangs of New York, it was a bunch of fucking people killing each other, but at least they were organized or united by a certain thing, by this immigrant group, or that neighborhood, or, you know, these loyalties. There was this idea where there was still, like, people will still congregate together and will still join together. There was a herd mentality inherent with people, and I wanted to kind of see that in New York. Like, okay, what makes this neighborhood particularly dangerous? Why did the Duke or Brain choose to set up camp in this neighborhood instead? Or you know, there's a land and a geographical. People are going to laugh at me. There is a diversity and a uniqueness to the different neighborhoods of New York City that I think, even if it is a prison colony, there is still going to be a certain demographic of people being attracted to a certain neighborhood because of something which is inherent in both people and the way that the city is organized. And so the fact that it's just like, oh, it's New York, and then just dropped it, and instead, like, let's throw in a yellow cab driver, let's throw in mention of the Lower East Side, let's throw in mention of the World Trade Towers. It's almost sort of just like I said, like, he just sort of had a bunch of terms and knew of some locations. He didn't know them, but he knew of them, and he just kind of, like, threw them out there. And it doesn't feel, and this is so weird, because it's, one, it's a movie, and two, it's a movie about New York City, the island of Manhattan, as a prison, but there doesn't seem to be anything organic or natural about that. And I realize that this complaint sounds weird, but I think if you're from New York, you might understand what I'm saying. You know, because I listen, and what I'm not saying is that if there's a bunch of Asian prisoners in this island colony, they're all going to congregate in Chinatown. Or if there's a bunch of Hispanic prisoners, they're all going to go to Spanish Harlem. I am not saying that. But what I am saying is that there is still something inherent. There is a spirit in these neighborhoods, in how they're constructed, in what the architecture is like, in where they're located. You know, obviously, you're going to have some type of tactical advantage if you are closer to the water or not. Or what kind of goons would end up, you know, kind of populating in Central Park versus, you know, Tribeca. You know, that kind of stuff. I wanted to see that. I wanted to see the diversity. I wanted to see, you know, the identity of these criminals associated with the identity of the city, and I didn't see that. They just kind of say New York, and then after that, it's just kind of this broken, beaten-down city that could have really been anywhere. You know, it's just a gimmick, and there was something that bugged me about that. But I realized that is specific to me. That's specific to me as a New Yorker. You people in Los Angeles might be thinking, well, that's stupid, and you might be laughing at me, and I understand that, because we in New York laugh at you people in Los Angeles all the time. Let's just clear the air and admit that to each other, that we're all laughing at each other. Sorry, people in the Midwest. I didn't mean to leave you out of this. So that was the first thing that sort of bugged me about it. And I also wondered, and I couldn't decide if Carpenter was poking fun at New York City, or kind of judging it, or if once again he was satirizing a perception of New York City. Because I do genuinely believe the more space I get, or the more space I get between my viewing of Assault on Precinct 13 and where I am now, I do genuinely believe that I think Carpenter was satirizing people's fear of the war zone in this terrible urban area, which Los Angeles was, you know, was, or, you know, with air quotes around that. I do believe that, you know, because he's a smart guy and he was aware of the situation that he was in, of the country that he lived in, of the attitudes that people had in the area around him. So I believe he's a smart guy, but then, if I believe that, then I also have to believe that he's smart enough to also kind of see through the fact that, you know, New York was not as terrible as people said. But, you know, when this movie was made, this was, you know, this was pre-Reagan, obviously, you know, so before that big push to, you know, to purity and cleanliness, that big illusion that everybody believed came about from the 1980s, and also before, you know, New York City had really started cleaning itself up. So it still had a reputation of being a dingy kind of broken city that people were, that, you know, white people were trying to get out of, and that was like, that was unsalvageable and unsavable. So it still had that reputation. It wasn't the 70s anymore, but it wasn't too far removed from the 70s either. So I have to believe that he could take his own experience and kind of be like, listen, I know it can't be that bad because that's what people think about where I came from, and it's not that bad. But at the same time, part of this film was inspired by him taking a trip to a seedy part of New York City. And I can't find details as to what part of the city he saw, but he used, you know, part of his inspiration was what he saw around them. So art imitates life, you know, so is that what he believed life was actually like? And I also wonder about the musical number, the one musical number, which is in Escape from New York, in which Snake Plissken comes into a theater and he meets the cabbie for the first time. And there's a bunch of dudes dressed in ladies' clothing kind of singing a song that is about New York City. And just so that you can understand what I'm talking about, I'm going to read the words to that song right now so you can kind of at least understand a little bit better where I'm coming from here. So, shoot a cop with a gun, the Big Apple is plenty of fun. Stab a priest with a fork and you'll spend your vacation in New York. Rob a bank, take a truck, you can get here by stealing a buck. This is bliss, it's a lark. Honey, everyone's coming to New York. No more Yankees, strike the word from your ears. Play the roulette, there's no more opera at the Met. This is hell, this fate, but now this is your home and it's great. So rejoice, pop a cork. Honey, everyone's coming to New York. And that scene, don't get me wrong, that scene is played for laughs. I genuinely believe you were supposed to laugh at that, so. But then I also have, like, those lyrics are kind of like, hey, this is New York, this is a shithole, this is hell. And I realize that in that context, they are talking about the New York City that they currently live in. And like I said, that scene is played for laughs. But I also just think of the fact, like, this movie was inspired by his trip to a seedy part of New York City. Does he believe that this is what New York City is really like? Because once again, there's a West Coast and an East Coast bias. He probably loved Los Angeles, and if he was satirizing the attitude towards violence and what people thought about it, then, you know, that's all well and good. But then if he loves his home in Los Angeles, is he also skeptical of that other city in the East Coast of New York City? Because once again, people in L.A. kind of make fun of people in New York City, and people in New York City kind of make fun of people in L.A. So is he, once again, satirizing this idea of like, oh my God, New York City, it's this terrible place to go. Everyone are monsters there, and in a couple decades, it's gonna devolve into a hellhole. Or is he kind of thinking like, yeah, I've been to New York, I saw it, it's a shithole there. What everybody says is right. And I can't really tell. It seems a little bit clear to me in Assault on Precinct 13 because I know that he came from there because that was his home and that's what he loved. But he was viewing New York City as an outsider. And as I kind of detailed in my tirade against the lack of diversity in his New York, he's viewing New York as an outsider that doesn't seem to really have an understanding of what New York is, but he has an understanding of what a perception of New York is. So I find it harder to kind of write it off as satire and kind of think more like, maybe Carpenter is just, maybe he was making fun of New York. But he didn't really understand what made New York great. But that's not my only problem, and that's not even my biggest problem. My biggest problem with Escape in New York is actually the same thing that I sort of had with Assault on Precinct 13, only on a bigger scale, in the sense of I know nothing about these characters, and none of these characters make sense to me. And that starts and ends with Snake Plissken, because I understand that Snake Plissken has gotten to this iconic point. He is a beloved anti-hero, and this sort of, if not kickstarted Kurt Russell's career, then at least showed people that, like, Kurt Russell could be more than that Disney guy, you know, that he was. Because a lot of people forget, Kurt Russell was a Disney guy for a long time. I believe he was in the original Herbie the Love Bug. Don't quote me on that. But this showed that Kurt Russell had range and that he had talent. And I do believe that if there was any other actor in this role, Snake Plissken would have been completely worthless in my mind. You have this guy, like, yes, he's an anti-hero, and we get that because he's very distrustful and very kind of scornful towards the police, the authorities that, you know, essentially force him to do this job by saying, like, hey, do this or you're going to be dead in 24 hours. So we're kind of immediately, like, on his side because of that, like, well, screw you guys for forcing this guy into this situation. And we kind of get a hint that, like, yes, he's a criminal, but he also has a military background, so we know that he wasn't born a bad guy, but he did something to make him a bad guy. But we know nothing else outside of that. And so if I don't know anything about this character, how am I supposed to be invested in what he's doing? Because the main reason that I'm invested in what he's doing, at least the main reason that Carpenter gives me, is the fact that he's less of a jerk than the jerks that forced him into this. And for me, that's not enough to get on board with a character. And we also have this perception, at least I had this perception coming in here, that Snake Plissken is this humongous badass. And, like, I'm just not seeing that. Sure, he's got an eye patch and he talks kind of gravelly. And, yeah, he kills that Zangief guy in that forced wrestling match with a nailed baseball bat. But there's nothing about Snake Plissken which makes me think, like, yeah, this guy is really good at something. There's no reason I should be rooting for this guy. There definitely seems to be a reputation because everyone says, oh, Snake Plissken, I thought you were dead. It's kind of a running gag that, like, everyone knows Snake Plissken. Everyone thought he was dead. But why? Why does everybody know him? Why is everyone intimidated by this guy? Why does his reputation precede him? Unless I missed something, unless I blinked or I was texting or doing something, unless I missed something, as far as I know, there's no reason that Snake Plissken's reputation comes before him. Is it because of his military service? Does everybody know him because of that? But I mean, Manhattan, guys and girls, Manhattan is 11 miles long. And, I mean, even people who, I don't know, but what I'm trying to say and failing is that, or yeah, what I'm trying to say and failing at it is that 11 miles is a lot of people. A lot of people in there. So you have to have done something really huge, really significant in order for anyone that you come across in that 11-mile stretch to know who you are. But the film doesn't explain that. And so I have to believe that, you know, it's just kind of what, on blind faith? Like, hey, here's our main character. He's a badass. Just trust me on this one, guys. Just trust me on that. Even though the fact that I'm not explaining to you why, and I'm not necessarily going to show you why. You're just going to have to get on board with the fact that this guy is a badass, and he's less of a jerk than these jerks that forced him into this, you know, despicable situation, including the jerk he's trying to rescue who doesn't even appreciate the sacrifices that he went through anyway. Adversity, you know, brings about empathy. You know, I can certainly empathize with the situation that Snake is in, but I don't relate to him, and I don't necessarily get on board with him just because you're telling me that I have to. And then that trickles down to the supporting characters. There's really not a whole lot of explanation between his relationship, you know, him and Brain. You know, it just sort of seems like, well, we need to have them have a past in order for him to have some type of agency or reason to help Snake out, but that's not really explored into too great detail. And Harry Dean Stanton, who's typically a pretty reliable actor, just sort of seems like he's improvising his way through this and not terribly convincingly either. You have Adrienne Barbeau, who seems to only be there because, hey, boobs, and also because at the time she was married to John Carpenter. But Maggie's useless. What purpose is she supposed to have? Other than, I guess, some type of emotional connection between her and Brain, which that didn't even really make sense to me to begin with. And then why is the Duke in charge? Why is the Duke this guy? You know, it sort of seems like, you know, you have the cabbie kind of saying, like, or I don't know the exact words, but sort of alluding to, like, you'll see the Duke once, and then after that, you're dead. Okay, so what's special about the Duke? Why is the Duke king of Manhattan Island? Why is the Duke the head honcho, you know, the head prisoner? You know, there's nothing, there's not even anything really significant or intimidating about him as a character, which kind of like, oh, yeah, this is the big baddie, and that makes sense. No, it doesn't. We're just told that he's supposed to be the big baddie, but there's nothing about it, and, you know, God bless him, Isaac Hayes, but he's not the greatest actor in the world, you know? So maybe if Keith David was playing this part, then I could kind of be like, okay, wow, this guy has a gravitas, this guy has a has an aura about him, which, like, yeah, I am afraid of this guy. But the Duke, we're just kind of told the Duke is important. We're shown that he drives a car with little chandeliers in the front, but it's just, but what is it about him? And if I don't know anything about him, if I don't have a reason that I should be afraid of him, why should Snake be afraid of him? And then why should I care about the struggle between these two guys? And so, like, these characters are archetypes, and maybe that was on purpose. Maybe Carpenter was purposely giving us archetypes because of, I don't know, his genre homage, but to me it sort of seems like it's either, not that it's on accident, but he kind of had all, like I said, he sort of had all the parts there, he just can't really assemble them properly. And I want to say maybe that's because he hadn't yet kind of come into his own as a director, but then the movie he makes immediately after this, let me just double check before I make a fool of myself, but the movie he makes immediately after this is The Thing. And, yep, that is correct. The movie he makes immediately after this is The Thing, which is fantastically and effectively and masterfully directed. So the jump from, you know, Escape from New York to The Thing is, like, it's not just a jump, it's a leap. And I don't get the disparity between those two. That doesn't really make sense to me. So I guess I want to believe that it's on purpose, that he was doing this to, you know, making these thin archetypical characters for some type of reason, but that reason is escaping me. And so because it's escaping me, I just sort of have to kind of make sense of it by saying, like, well, maybe he just wasn't that great of a director yet. Even though Assault on Precinct 13 shows a dramatic command of tone from a if not first time, then a first time solo filmmaker, and then The Thing, which comes immediately after this, is an absolute masterpiece. So Escape from New York is this weird kind of anomaly in the middle, which is like okay, but not great, and just sort of like is a thing. I don't know. There's nothing. There's nothing about Escape from New York which elevates it, in my mind, to a classic status. I don't understand how Snake Plissken has evolved or been elevated to this idea of an iconic anti-hero. I don't understand why this is one. I wanted to say why this is one that Reed pointed to me. But I have to kind of take that with a grain of salt because it's because I've already saw The Thing that Reed kind of pointed me to Escape from New York. But I don't know, thinking on it now, it's kind of like, you know, if I was talking to someone else and recommending them some Carpenter stuff and they hadn't seen The Thing and Escape from New York, if both of those things, I definitely point to The Thing right away. It's just a very mediocre film to me and not something that I really kind of care to ever revisit. I was talking to a friend today who said that for what it's worth, every time he watches it, he finds it more entertaining and more weird and more cynical, and that's fine. I'm just not seeing anything in this first viewing which is encouraging me to ever go back and revisit it. It's just fine, you know? And I kind of, in a way, dislike fine viewing experiences more than really bad viewing experiences because, like, at least with a bad viewing experience, I can kind of point to something which at least, you know, if it's really bad, if it generates an angrier, like a visceral or emotional response for me, at least that means it's like it's connecting to something. But just a fine emotional experience or a fine viewing experience is sort of like I don't know what else I can really connect to or talk about, which I realize is a little bit ironic considering I've already surpassed the length of my Assault on Precinct 13 episode, which I did very much like that movie. And so here I am going on and on and on about how I don't have much to talk about with Escape from New York when I've clearly done that. Bottom line, yeah, I don't like saying this very much, but I don't really necessarily get the love from Escape from New York, or at least I don't necessarily understand how it could be elevated above cult classic status into classic status. But I have to be thankful for it, because Escape from New York made on a very small budget and very successfully financially, and got Carpenter the gig directing The Thing, which is, as I've already established, a masterpiece. So I'm sure many of you out there disagree with me. That's fine. If you do, I actually really want to hear from you, of course. But once again, we'll get to that in a little bit. Because first and foremost, if you want to revisit this, or if you've never seen it before, but are for some reason listening to this episode, it's easy to get your hands on it. I watched it through Amazon, which is easy to rent or stream. In both an SD or an HD feature. I went for the HD feature because that's the kind of person that I am. And I also put this on Facebook that if you have a subscription to something called Comic-Con HQ, which is a streaming service that I didn't know exists, you can watch it for free through Amazon with your subscription to Comic-Con HQ. If you don't have Comic-Con HQ, as I'm sure most of you don't, easy enough to rent or purchase on iTunes, easy enough to rent on Vudu, also rent on the PlayStation and the Microsoft stores, so it's easy enough to get your hands on, but as you may have guessed, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. Maybe watch The Thing again instead, because it's a masterpiece. But yeah, if you have been listening to this, and you are upset with me, and you do disagree with me, you are the one that I want to hear from. Or if you are the one that's like, hey, I get what you're saying, but here's what I saw about it, I still want to hear from you. I always want to hear from you. Hey, once again, it's 100 episodes. I would not be doing this if it wasn't for you listening. And if you are listening, it's because you have something to say. And if you have something to say, I want to hear you say it. And it's easy enough for you to do that because you can email me at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. You can find I Do Movies Badly on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Nolan Fixes Teeth, though... just today I started entertaining the idea of getting off of Twitter because it's sort of Escape from New York-ish in the sense of how disastrous it is every time I go on there. And you can catch up on back episodes of I Do Movies Badly at iTunes, or go to BattleshipRetention.com, the episodes drop-down menu, and find I Do Movies Badly. That does it for... Escape from New York. That once again, I want to thank all my past guests for helping contribute to this ongoing cinematic conversation and edification. I want to thank the listeners for sticking through this, for my random musings, for my waffling sometimes and not being entirely sure of myself and my opinions. That is something that I continuously work on in my personal life, so it's something that I have to obviously apply here in being more confident in myself, being more confident in my opinions, because once again, the podcast is called I Do Movies Badly. It means that I do things badly, but it also means that I am doing it, me, Jim Rohner, and not somebody else. So if you have stuck around and you are still listening, I do want to thank you, but I, of course, also do want to hear from you, because I don't do this just for myself. That is a big part of it, but I also do it because I love discourse and I love conversation and I love hearing from people and engaging ideas. I have an email from Christopher who chimed in earlier, and I have to respond to that email, and so if I have not done it by now when you're listening to this episode, Christopher, I am sorry, but I will get around to it eventually, because I always do at some point get around to responding to my listener feedback, because I appreciate the fact that you are chiming in. But yes, that is that. Oh, how did I forget this? Before I sign off, I guess I have to say, if you are a listener in the States, then I certainly hope that you have a very safe, a very healthy, a very healthy, and a very happy Thanksgiving. This is my, on a personal note, this is the first year that I will not be returning home for Thanksgiving. I am doing a Friendsgiving. And man, I mean, I think about the people that I'm with. I think about how, yeah, it's been a shitty year, man. I mean, in so many regards, this has been a shitty year. And some of us are going to be really thankful when it's over, but some of us are also kind of dreading what's to come. We're not sure. There's many reasons to or many things which are distracting us or diverting us away from hope and instead getting into fear and insecurity. But I think it's important for us all to remember that things... I'm trying to think of how I can say this without, you know, kind of writing off people's pain or hurt or suffering, kind of making it sort of a, everything happens for a reason, or everything will be okay. But I've been through some terrible times as well, but there's always been blessings, you know, right next to me. Sometimes it's hard to remember that, sometimes it's hard to see that, but that's why I think that this time of year, once again, this, you know, this is... might be a little bit specific towards our, you know, my American audience who you know, is celebrating Thanksgiving this coming Thursday. But I think these are words for all of us to kind of keep in mind, is that we may look into the future and kind of see, you know, fires on the horizon, and that smoke may be getting in our eyes and blinding us, when, and that sometimes causes us to ignore or overlook the fact that standing right next to us are blessings all around us. And, it has been a hard year, and it might be, you know, there might be some hard times in the future, but there are still so many things that I am thankful for, including my friends, including my family, including the fact that I have the freedom and the privilege to do this in an apartment that is, that I can afford, that has heat, that has air conditioning, electricity, and running water. And there are so many things that we take for granted on an everyday basis, and I am trying to keep those things in mind through this time of uncertainty, and I hope that that you boys and girls can do the same thing, you know, that you can delight in something as simple as a hug or someone giving you a seat on the subway or kind of letting you in traffic. That's for you, LA people. So many blessings around us, and I just hope that we don't lose sight of that permanently. But that's it. That's done. That's off with the sentimentality. I started with sentimentality. I'll end with sentimentality. And I will... So once again, yes. Happy Thanksgiving to all my American listeners. To all my non-American listeners, once again, that message was not... You know, it might have been exclusive to them in the sense of like, hey, this is the time of the year when we specifically meant to do these things. But I think this is something that we can all kind of keep in mind and certainly all take to heart. So happy Thanksgiving. To those of you who are celebrating, to those of you who are not celebrating, thank you so much for listening, and thank you for being fans, and thank you for contributing to this thing, which I think is its own blessing as well. So be sure to tune in next week, where I will be wrapping up John Carpenter Month with In the Mouth of Madness, and hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.